is not enough.
Oh, oh, man. My loving God, can't get enough of your love, man. Girl, I don't know why, can't get enough of your love, man.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
It's like the more you give, the more I want. And maybe that's no lie. Oh, no, man. Tell me.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. We have a packed show today. And from all over the world, from all the syndicated programs and cities, from people living in small villages, large cities, I want to thank you for being on board. I promised that I would do something involving the brain because it can impact everyone. So today, instead of doing my normal health and nutrition updates, I'm going to do like a classroom on the air, about 20 minutes of staying mentally sharp as we age, in effect strategies for fighting memory loss, depression, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, multiple sclerosis. Then I'm going to have one of our scholars in residence, and I believe we're the only radio program that actually has on staff full-time people who have backgrounds of deep scholarship, who are nonpartisan, and who will look at issues by seeing the truth in them. So today, everything that the mainstream and much of the liberal media has told you about Trump's trip to the Middle East, and what he is saying in Saudi Arabia and the other 50 Arab nations that were involved, we will give you a different perspective. We're going to compare what's actually happening today in Iran with Saudi Arabia as just a simple way of defining it. So we'll have everything that is accurate and provable that Iran stands for and is doing, and everything that's accurate and provable that Saudi Arabia stands for. We have only heard one thing. We've heard lies about what Saudi Arabia stands for, and we've heard lies about what Iran represents. So, the truth today. And then, following that, the story of the CIA-sponsored terrorism to remove Castro, and further evidence that the CIA was involved in this JFK assassination. From Miami, Florida, Carlos Harrison. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He is the former national and international correspondent for major news agencies, reported for the Miami Herald, and has written two award-winning television documentaries. He's also written seven featured screenplays, hundreds of articles, including The Invasion of Panama and the hostage crisis at the Japanese embassy in Peru. He writes on Brazilian economics, clandestine activities inside Cuba during the mass boat exodus in the mid-1970s. He is also the former managing editor of People en Español, and he's written several books. And his latest book is Trained to Kill, the inside story of the CIA plots against Castro, Kennedy, and Che Guevara. And we were going to have on Antonio Veciana, an exiled Cuban and CIA asset who founded the anti-Castro terrorist group Alpha 66, and who had associations with Lee Harvey Oswald and Oswald's CIA handler, David Attlee Phillips, and also known as AKA Maurice Bishop. But we found that he was very limited in his English, and so Carlos is coming on in his stead to explain everything. So you're going to hear stuff today you've never heard, information that has never been made public, but is all fully documented. Now, if time permits, I'll also play you a short, brand new segment from Julian Assange. It's only 27 seconds, but boy, does he say it, on how Saudi Arabia has been funding all along ISIS. So how can you be fighting terrorism and ISIS if you're not addressing one of its, if not the chief financial support for ISIS? And also Denis Kucinich, why do we do a deal with a country connected to terror, meaning Saudi Arabia? So we'll see how much time we have. But we begin today by taking a look at something that impacts every single one of us, and that's our mentality as we age. Everyone in this audience, I'm sure, is familiar with Alzheimer's disease. Famous people get it. Ronald Reagan had it. And you can't always tell because the person looks all right. In fact, they can look very fit. It's very easy to be fit but not healthy. I used to run with a guy named Jim Fix. And this is long before I was a race walker. I was a runner. And Fix, when I would, he'd be in New York and I would meet him, we'd run and we'd talk. And he wasn't into nutrition. He said he could eat anything. And he did. I remember Bill Rogers being on my radio show after he had won, I think, 3 or 4 New York City marathons. And I said, what role do you think nutrition plays? And he said, well, I eat donuts all the time. You know, I run it off. No, you don't. You may not gain weight because you're running, but you're prematurely aging yourself by everything you do, including things you did early in life. So you can't tell if a person has something wrong with their brain just by looking at their outside, because it can seem fine. Also, the same is true for Parkinson's. Sadly, people that so many people know and respect, like Muhammad Ali, when he got Parkinson's, I'm sure that the best that medicine could provide was given to him. But I received a call from someone very close to him in his inner circle and said, I know that you helped some other people with Parkinson's. You helped a man, an African-American engineer named Thomas. He was in a PBS special I did, and you completely reversed it. That's true, I said. We've also heard that you work with Arthur Ashe. I said, that's not true. I said, Arthur Ashe came to my office sometimes every single night for hours to talk with people who I was working with who had full-blown AIDS. I work with 1,200 people. I gave them the protocols. The medical doctors administered the protocols. I did not charge them. I paid for it out of my own pocket. And 12 of those people completely reversed their AIDS and appeared on Tony Brown's journal. So within the African-American community, because of Tony Brown, Arthur Ashe, Arthur was interested. He believed that the therapy worked. He just never had the confidence to take it. But Stokely Carmichael, a whole lot of very famous African-Americans I've worked with. Some, I will mention their names because they've mentioned it. The publisher of the Amsterdam News, Bill Tatum, a really outstanding journalist and a tennis player, Doug Henderson. So it was not unlikely that a Muhammad Ali would find out that I was doing this work. So I said, I've helped a lot of people and, you know, talk with them and see what they tell you the outcome was. And he said, how difficult is the protocol? I said, it's not difficult if you're willing to give up certain foods, beverages, and take certain supplements that can help rebuild the brain, to take the amyloid plaque out, to help the central nervous system, to help the musculature. So it's not something you can do haphazardly. You really have to do it, and you have to stick with it. But all the people who benefited, they were 100% on board. There was this pause, and I said, I'd be happy to see him and happy to sit with him and provide him the best that I know. Whatever I know, I will give him. I do that with everyone. I don't care if they're famous or not. I don't hold anything back. If it's in my awareness, I'm going to share it. He said, well, there's a bit of a problem here. I said, what's that? He's not going to change anything. I said, well, you can't have it both ways. You can't keep everything you're doing that has caused the Parkinson's or any other condition and then add something else in. It doesn't work. And I said, however, I'm always available. If he wants my help, happy to help him. Never called back, never heard again, and we know the outcome. Now, what would have been the likely outcome? I don't know. I can't say that every single person, tens of thousands, have stuck with the protocol, have gotten the outcome they wanted, but an awful lot are alive and well today who did, that we do know. So what I'm suggesting is this, that one protocol that is general can help everyone's brain. And then you need to fine-tune it with specifics depending upon each person, their age, the manifestation of their symptoms. But for everyone who wants to not face that terror of brain diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, first, however, I want to share with this audience the reasons why our brains succumb to degeneration. You've heard about some of them already in previous radio programs and lectures and health support groups. And Sunday night, I did 3 hours on this, about slowing down and reversing aging. And that webinar is up on my website, GaryNall.com, if you missed it. I keep saying this to people, and they just don't always pay attention, but please do. If I tell you to sign up early for something, a lecture or a retreat or a detox or a health support group, it's because every single one we do is packed, and webinars in particular. So we had to stop and cut it off, couldn't allow any more in, and thousands of people wanted to get in, waited too late and didn't get in. So I'm sorry that you didn't get in, but it's there now, and you can go. Just like when I say, you know, you never know when you tune on at noon, since I'm all over the place, if that particular radio station has had any problems, technical problems, as one did recently in New York where the phone system went out, and the internet went out, or not the internet, but the phone system, so they didn't carry my show that day. And then people called my office, well, what do I do? Well, we've told you 1,000 times, just call a phone number. Let me give you the phone numbers. So this way you'll be able to connect right in. 701-801-3662. 701-801-3662. Because the type of world we live in today, we never know if there's going to be continuity or consistency or sustainability tomorrow. But at least I'm broadcasting every day, Monday to Friday, noon to 1, and Tuesday, 7 to 8. And you can listen by any portable device by that phone number. If you miss it, want to listen to the archive show, you might not have time to listen to live, I'll give you a separate phone number, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Now, we've talked about bad diets, toxins, over 100,000 chemicals in the environment. They can all get into our bodies. And the evidence is all there, documented in scientific journals, thousands of journal articles. But allopathic medicine and science is still determined to find a drug to supposedly cure these conditions. They haven't, they won't, it's not possible. But they're rewarded for their efforts, not for the results. I don't believe that it's going to happen. I don't believe it's possible. Why? I've seen these conditions reversed on holistic protocols over a period of time. It might take a year, 2 years, but I've seen it happen. I believe that they represent the best approach, the holistic approach. So I want to give you some specifics so you better understand why we suffer from progressive decline in our cognitive ability. Basically, our ability to memorize and recognize. And this decline often begins with short-term memory loss and the inability to learn new information. Simple memory defects, if not addressed, can worsen over time. A group from the USDA, Neuroscience Laboratory Research Center on Aging at Tufts University, warned that in the very near future, almost 30% of the entire population will be over 65 years of age, and we will have a pandemic of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So what this means is that we need to act now, even if you're in your 20s, because neurological diseases like senility and dementia and Alzheimer's manifest most commonly as you get older, but it's progressive. The good news is that many of these underlying reasons why people suffer memory loss and other neurological disturbances can be corrected. Here's the list, so write these down, please. Chronic inflammation, that's number one, because that injures both the cerebral blood vessels and the neurons, which are your brain cells. A bad diet that leads to nutrient deficiencies. Almost everyone that I counsel, when I see their blood work up, they're deficient in nutrients like magnesium, calcium, zinc, selenium, vitamin D. Also, hormonal imbalances and decreased levels of key hormones. What are your most important hormones? DHEA. Your body produces it, and from it, other hormones are produced. Also, you've got to check your thyroid and testosterone levels. A decrease in oxygen to the brain cells because of impaired circulation due to narrowing of your arteries, heart disease, atherosclerosis, because you don't exercise. You spend too much time sitting. And also just a lifetime of stress. Also declining energy output of brain cells due to nutrient deficiency. The mitochondria simply don't have enough energy for you to have a good sharp memory. The essential fatty acid deficiencies. Every brain cell requires EPA in its cell membrane. We don't eat EPAs. The damaging effects of chronic free radical exposure, and also something that's the giant in the room, the adverse side effects of prescription medications. Now, I've talked about free radicals many times on this program, but these free radicals are such an important factor in aging that they can bear additional mentioning in conjunction with neurological disease. Once again, we know that free radicals are atoms with unpaired electrons that can cause damage in the normal metabolic process known as oxidation. Brain cells are particularly vulnerable to oxidative damage because of their high energy production. They're constantly firing messages back and forth. So if you were to exercise, you're going to be healthier, but you're going to age prematurely. Here's the irony. When you do a run around Central Park, which is 6 miles, you're creating the free radicals equivalent to smoking a pack of cigarettes. So yes, you'll have less fat, you'll have stronger muscles, you'll have created some good endorphins, the feel-good opiate your brain creates that allow you to feel calmer for the next 5 to 6 hours. You'll speed up your digestion, you'll lower your pulse rate after initially speeding up for the exercise, but you've also created oxidative stress, meaning you've prematurely damaged cells. You won't notice it then. 20 years later, you will, because your legs, your muscles in your legs won't be 40. When you're 40, they'll be 70. And hence, you see a lot of people who were overly athletic younger and who can't do anything later. Now, there is a way called compensation. So you take your antioxidants before you work out, after you work out, and that compensates for the free radicals. It diminishes the free radicals. So the more energy produced, like exercise, the greater number of damaging free radicals occur. And the destructive effect of free radical activity have been implicated in Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and cancers. Also, we know that free radicals produced in the brain really damage neurons. And so we can end up what is called leakage of electrons from the energy produced in mitochondria electrical transport. And other free radicals are generated for useful purposes, such as the role of nitric oxide in neurotransmission and in the production of oxygen. But because the brain requires constant energy in the form of ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate, it consumes oxygen rapidly, and it thus produces these accidents of chemistry regularly. In order to deal with the constant production of free radicals, the brain contains a battery of antioxidant defenses, and two of the most important defenses are the mitochondrial superoxide dismutase containing manganese and glutathione. And we have to be reminded that iron is a powerful promoter of free radical damage. When you're on a big meat-based diet, you're taking in a lot of iron. You don't want that. All that meat, all that protein that you're eating from animal sources, you're damaging your brain, your liver, and your kidneys, and your heart. Now, even though iron in the brain is stored in ferritin, when the brain is damaged or injured, iron is released and causes more injury. And if you're on a vegan diet, you don't have that problem. So the importance of free radicals in the aging brain is being studied fervently. in the hopes of finding a drug that will stop free radicals. Well, hello, vitamin C stops free radicals. I'm going to go through a list of things that will stop free radicals. And there are increasing levels of free radical damage to DNA, lipids, and proteins found in postmortem tissue of patients with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and ALS, the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And there's some speculation that at least some of these changes may occur early on. So here's the good news. The good news is that we want the antioxidants, such as vitamin E, tocotrienols, tocotrienol, the carotenoids, hence a glass of vegetable juice, eating your yellow, red, purple fruits and vegetables, the flavonoids. But they do not easily cross the blood-brain barrier. Some other antioxidants must be found, and I'll get to those. So we have inflammation. Inflammation then creates more free radicals. The free radicals then damage the cells. In the damaging of the cells, we frequently cannot then have good, healthy DNA and good, healthy mitochondria. So we need energy in order to have a functioning brain, and we need oxygen. But because of poor diet and a lot of sugar and a lot of meat, we've narrowed our arteries. We've calcified our arteries. We've blocked our carotid artery. So we have to start taking green juices in order to open up the blocked artery. That's not that difficult to do. But you have to do it daily. Lots of vegetables, lots of fruits. So what specific nutrients will help your brain? Well, as far as juices, beet juice, beet with blueberry. You talk about a phenomenal juice for your brain, for every condition of the brain. Take a pint of blueberries and 8 ounces of beet juice. Juice the blueberries and then drink that down twice a day. Another great juice for the brain would be a pound of pomegranates. Now, you can eat the pomegranate, but I prefer the pomegranate concentrate or juice. And then have that with watermelon juice. That's good as well. Now, certain vitamins are known to impact brain chemistry in a good way. The B complex, 50 milligrams to 100 milligrams, is essential for energy and for proper production of hormones. In fact, one recent study determined not only that low folate, which is a B vitamin, levels are associated with cognitive defects, but also that patients treated with folic acid for 60 days showed a significant improvement in memory and attention. And then another one, a 6-year study, determined the relationship between nutritional status and cognitive performance. And what was it they were taking? Vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, and B complex. And that had a significant improvement in performance on abstraction and visuospatial test. In addition to a direct effect, we're also learning that vitamins indirectly impact mental function by altering the levels of harmful or beneficial substance in the body. For instance, we don't want elevated homocysteine because that's linked to greater heart disease and poor cognitive function. But when you're taking vitamin B6, 100 milligrams, folic acid, 1 milligram, B12, 1 milligram, you're reducing homocysteine, preventing heart disease, and helping your brain. In fact, one study revealed that less than optimal levels of B6, B12, and folic acid led to a deficiency in SAMe, which is an acetylsalicylated methionine deficiency, and that causes depression, dementia, and demyelinating of degeneration of the nerves. So you need SAMe. In fact, we're finding out just how functionally proper these things are. You need a lot of vitamin C, generally 5,000 to 10,000 milligrams a day. And I have found more studies that show the absolute need for nutrients on the brain. In fact, there's an article in Psychopharmacology describing a study of elderly individuals given vitamin B6 versus a placebo, and it improved their memory. That was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine. There was also another article about vitamin B12 injections and in the New England Journal of Medicine. And again, for memory loss, for muscle weakness, you need B12, 1 milligram methylated. And the methylated part of this is what helps this coenzyme form a B12 really make a difference. So you need your B12, you need folic acid, you need vitamin E. In fact, with vitamin E, depending upon if it's Alzheimer's, I might suggest 2,000 units of alpha tocopherol and then 200 units of the mixed tocotrienols. But there are some superstars that also can make a difference. Here are the superstars for any form of mental problem in your brain. Acetyl L-carnitine, that's very important. Alpha-lipoic acid, the greater the oxidative damage to nucleic acids occurring predominantly in the RNA and not the DNA, you need acetyl L-carnitine and alpha-lipoic acid, generally 600 milligrams of alpha-lipoic acid, 1,000 milligrams of L-carnitine. Acetyl L-carnitine can significantly reduce the extent of the damage to the RNA. We also need to know that the acetyl L-carnitine can really help the mitochondria, the energy factories of the body, and the neurological aging is slowed down. The coenzyme Q10. Coenzyme Q10 is very important. It's in every cell of our body, but as you age, you can't produce enough, and if you're taking statins, it destroys it. It is there to help the mitochondria, all the cells of the brain and the heart and the others in the body. It facilitates and regulates the breakdown of fats and sugars into energy, and you need that. And it can help your heart in a big way. It helps your brain in a big way. I've seen what it does. In fact, there's studies showing that it can increase the cerebral cortex region of the brain, the nutrients getting in there substantially. And when a neurotoxin was administered in one experiment, coenzyme Q10 helped protect against damage to the region of the brain where dopamine is produced. So when you're taking coenzyme Q10, you're helping yourself maintain a better chemistry in the brain, and that helps you with things such as depression and anxiety and some of these other symptoms. But there are also some other nutrients I consider essential. Choline, C-H-O-L-I-N-E, and lecithin. And these are the most common memory-enhancing nutrients or precursors to the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. And because acetylcholine helps brain cells communicate with each other, it plays an important role in learning and memory, and especially short-term learning. So when you can't remember where you left something, it may be because of deficiency of acetylcholine. And so you want to take that which helps the body produce acetylcholine. And that's where your choline and lecithin come in. And also, we have found it lessens the opportunity for stroke, Alzheimer's, and transient ischemic attacks. Then the essential fatty acids, the EPA. Now, there's EPA and DHA, and it's the DHA that has the greatest impact upon the brain, generally in the neighborhood of 1,500 milligrams a day. Then vinpocetin, vin, V-I-N, po, P-O, cetin, C-E-T-I-N. Look, we know that normal aging results in a reduction of blood flow to the brain and a decrease in the metabolic activity of brain cells. Fortunately, however, there are dietary supplements that specifically enhance circulation to the brain. And an extract of the periwinkle plant called vinpocetin, which I just mentioned, was introduced about 25 years ago in Europe for the treatment of cerebrovascular disorders and symptoms related to senility. And since then, it's been really great for helping treat cognitive defects and dementia and some of the impacts of normal aging. And it increases and enhanced circulation, increases oxygen utilization in the brain, and increases tolerance of the brain towards diminished blood flow, and inhibits abnormal platelet aggregation that can interfere with circulation or cause a stroke. Ginkgo biloba also enhances circulation of the brain. What is called PS. P stands for phosphatidyl, and then S for serine, phosphatidyl serine. Very important because it's a concentrated source of nutrients that protect brain cell membranes. And one of these phosphatidyl lipids is phosphatidylserine, which plays an important role in maintaining the integrity of brain cell membranes. And that helps you with everything. Dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. So you definitely want that. Garlic is good. Now, I think garlic is great because it lowers blood pressure, lowers cholesterol, fights infections, but it also helps the brain. Yeah, garlic Garlic is beneficial for reducing oxygen-mediated brain cell damage that's implicated in Alzheimer's disease. Now, melatonin is also crucial because it's the most important antioxidant your brain actually creates from the pineal gland, and it detoxifies a variety of free radicals, including the hydroxyl radicals in the NN and single oxygen and nitric oxide. So it's terrific for the brain, so you want to make sure you're getting it. So those are some of the basics. Now, there are a lot more, but at least, and especially DHEA, about 15 milligrams a day. But for Parkinson's, lycopene, generally around 25 milligrams, lutein, 25 milligrams, vitamin C, about 10 to 15,000 milligrams, green tea, about 1,000 milligrams, up to 10 glasses of green juice a day, a melatonin, acetyl-L-carnitine, phosphatidylserine, alpha-lipoic acid, coenzyme Q10, ginkgo, ginseng, and pine bark extract, or pycnogenol. That will help Parkinson's, along with a high-quality vegan diet and making sure you're getting enough of the nut butters into your system. So there we went, over a half hour into this program, but at least now you have information you didn't have before that hopefully will make a difference. Now, we're going to go directly over, before we go to our guest in about 10 minutes, I wanted to bring on now Richard Gale. Richard is a scholar. He has a lot of background in these issues. I want to speak with Richard before we go to our guest. Nice to have you with us today, Richard.
How are you, Gary? Good afternoon.
Richard, the media, almost universally, including much of the liberal media, is thinking that everything is happening as far as Trump meeting with the Arab nations and Arab leaders, over 50, having agreed with Saudi Arabia to have Saudi Arabia lead the attack against Islamic extremists in the Middle East, and that he would be there to fully support him. And then also his comments about actually supporting the Sunni type of the Muslim belief system rather than the Shia by aligning the Shia with Iran and demonizing Iran in this current trip. And the media was going along with this, that the greatest threat in the Middle East to its stability and peace and terror is Iran, and that, in effect, the countries that are going to help protect it are Israel and Saudi Arabia, leading the list. You have studied this. Give us your perspective on this, please, and compare Iran and Saudi Arabia, what the media is not telling us.
Well, it's so many things to what Trump says, and to one of the guests we had on before, Trump has very little understanding and appreciation of either history or even specifics and details. This is a man that thinks in labels. So when he says he supports the Saudi form of Sunnism, he's speaking about a very small sect within the greater Islamic world, and that's just strictly the Wahhabism, which is the fundamentalist kind of theology and thinking behind so many of the different terrorist organizations. And also for behind just extreme Islamic extremism around the world. You have to wonder whether Trump has any kind of appreciation and understanding of the nuances, of the many, many numerous nuances between that exist within Islam as a global world religion. We can go into one of the things we could jump right into, just the distinctions between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And this is actually a much longer conversation, but Iran just had its elections. Rouhani was reelected. It's not that you might think he wouldn't have been, because Iran's economy, due to years of sanctions and being cut off from trade with many of America and its allies, that you would think that there would be this a desire for even a more moderate in some ways to open up and with the country. Rouhani was this is an interesting election because he is a moderate. The favored candidate by the Supreme, what in Iran is kind of called the Supreme Council. Now, those are not, these are the ayatollahs. These are not, they're not elected by the citizenry. They're, you can think of them as the theologians that lay down the moral law and the moral code of Iran, unlike, and they're very divided. You have hardliners, you have moderates, you have liberals among this body of ayatollahs. That's very, very unlike Saudi Arabia, which only one form, one interpretation of Islam is sanctioned by the state to be practiced. And this is completely different than in Iran. In Iran, even though we say it's Shia, but Sunnis can publicly practice. They have mosques. There's 9 Sunni mosques in Tehran alone. You have the largest Jewish community in the Muslim world, or second largest after Turkey. They're in Iran. They identify themselves as Iranian. They're free to practice. There are on the Iranian parliament, there are seats designated strictly for the minority groups, for Christians, Jews, the Sunni, and the original religion of Persia, Iran, being the Zoroastrian or Parsis. So that you have, in fact, even there was one candidate that was running in this, and he was completely actually ignored. He got almost no votes. He was completely supported by the American hawks and hardliners. It's a very curious thing that even in their public elections, they allow some of these opposition groups. And some of these opposition groups are actually in exile. They're not even in Iran, but they are allowed, they're still on the ballots to vote. So I think there's kind of a view of looking at Iran as being just a nation of thought police. Like what you would find in Saudi Arabia, it's completely bogus. Women, I was reading one recent report about the youth. The youth in Iran would say that their life is very joyful. They have a lot of freedom. The women are educated. They can drive. They have to cover. There's a little more allowance, but they're not completely concealed behind closed doors, like in Saudi Arabia. There is a woman who sits on the Iranian parliament, although women in Iran tend to not enter politics, but they do. They go into professional careers, and there are more women at the university level in Iran than you would find men. There are rules concerning divorce favor women much more in among the Shia than amongst the Sunni. So that there's, in terms of an open society, regardless of what we may think about some of the more repressive sides of the Iranian government since the revolution, it's still a far more open society than anything Saudi Arabia has. Okay. So I think that's one of the important differences to make there.
Richard, I want to address several issues before we go to our guest who's standing by now. First and foremost, we, the United States, with President Eisenhower, on advice from the British Prime Minister and the British version of the CIA and our CIA, conspired on behalf of British Petroleum to have a coup and overthrow the democratically elected and very progressive Mossadegh, who had been the president of Iran. That coup succeeded, and in his place came the Shah of Iran. The Shah of Iran had a secret police force that was equal to Papa Doc's secret police force that captured, killed, tortured, rendered thousands upon thousands of people. But for the next quarter century, it was in effect under the thumb of the United States and the oil companies. And so that was only about oil and money and power in the Middle East. So when the Ayatollah Khomeini came back in, and we then, instead of trying to figure out how to work with them cooperatively, we instead funded Saddam Hussein into an eight-year war where the United States and the CIA provided cluster bombs, white phosphorus, and banned weapons of mass destruction, intelligence satellite surveillance to Saudi Arabia, excuse me, to the Iraq dictator, Saddam Hussein, and Iran lost over 1 million people. The American public's not aware of this. And so today you have a huge young audience, a huge, over 35% of the entire population of Iran, which is a huge country, over 81 million people, twice the size of Iraq. And these people tend to be more liberal, moderates and liberal. So it's, if you ask the average American about Iran, you would think that everybody was a terrorist wanting the nuclear bomb. And yet the International Atomic Energy Commission has stated recently that Iran is not now, nor have they been in the near future or past, engaged in developing nuclear weapons. Yet if you listen to Netanyahu, 15 years ago, he said they were just within months of getting it. And he keeps saying they've got it almost. And so that caused the United States and the Mossad to jointly develop malware that went in and blew up their centrifuges. And also, there was another one. I'm not sure the National Security Agency was a part of it, but Israel certainly was, where they had a second malware where this malware prevented electricity from going on. They could turn off all the electricity in Iran. Why would they do that? Why would you want all the electricity in a country out? Well, could it have been because it would have been a long flight from Israel to Iran and back? And if you had no defense mechanism, then you could militarily do whatever you wanted. Iran found out about it, and now they've tried to defend themselves. So we, the United States, have engaged in cyber warfare with a sovereign country. We've engaged in regime change. We have propagandized. And one side we have demonized, and the other side that is actually engaged in terror, funding terror, and it's a part of WikiLeaks, and we know it, and yet we are acting as if they had nothing to do with 9/11, that they had nothing to do with terrorism except fight terrorism, and that somehow now that the president's daughter got $100 million to her foundation this week from Saudi Arabia, that she's saying good things about how they treat their women. Really? Well, last time I saw, they were right beside ISIS and beheading, crucifying, and throwing gays off roofs. And they allowed no other religion in the country. And they allowed no democracy. And they allowed no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly. And none of this is being discussed in the media on this trip he's having. And that just final thoughts for me, because that's discouraging that we are so imbalanced in our reporting.
Because this is the big one. This is where most of the fire branding is going on. Iran's been working on a nuclear program since the 1950s. And it was back in 1968. This is under the Shah, when Iran signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and then it ratified it in 1970. Okay, now this is a treaty Israel has refused to join, as well as most international weapons treaties. Almost all the uranium that Iran has was purchased by South Africa back in the early 80s. They're not mining or anything like that. There is perhaps mining, but they're working with very, very old material that they've had there for many years. The nuclear boom of Iran was under the Shah, supported by the U.S. at that time. So what Khomeini and the White Revolution, you know, from the White Revolution, it started in 1963 when the Shah, there was the big protest in Tehran when the Shah, they slaughtered 15,000 people during a demonstration. That was when Khomeini was arrested. That was June 5th, 1963. So they inherited a nuclear program that was supported and sponsored by the United States and the UK during the time of the Shah. And, you know, so as we say, you know, the chickens come home to roost, and that's really what you have there.
Okay. I'm also very discouraged by the fact that we're bragging about a $110 billion weapons deal without asking, what will those weapons be used for? How many weapons will use against the innocent civilians and children, starving people in Yemen? How many of those will be used to fund terrorist groups and to fortify their stockpile of weapons? It's just, as long as it's good business for the United States, it's good. And we don't look deeper. And that's unfortunate. Richard, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, Gary.
Now let's go over and say hello to Carlos Harrison. I gave you his background at the beginning of the program. Thank you for being with us today, Carlos.
Thanks for having me, Gary. It's great to be here.
Carlos, we're not able to have Antonio on the program because of his limited English. Nevertheless, you worked closely with him in producing his memoirs about his activities in destabilizing Cuba during the Cold War and his assassination attempts on Castro and his involvement with the CIA during these operations. What I pull from Antonio's story is that even back in the 1950s and 60s, there was a power structure in place that we now refer to as the deep state, a mini-government or body of political decision-making that operated outside the rules of law with its own autonomy. And this would well describe the CIA's operations against Cuba, much which was going on under President Kennedy's nose before his assassination. So would you please begin by telling us some of that activity of the renowned CIA officer David Attlee Phillips, whose alias was Maurice Bishop, and what faction within the American CIA or even the State and Defense Departments at large did this darker element play in US-USSR Cuba tensions, and then speak about the role of Cuba played as a proxy state in the Cold War chess match that infuriated the hawks in the US government. The forum is yours.
Hi, this is Carlos.
Yes, Carlos.
Hey, I'm sorry we got disconnected for a moment there. I was able to listen to the wonderful discussion about Iran, and I thank you for having me. But I have been away for a few seconds, so hopefully we're diving into Cuba now, moving from one side
yes.
of the globe to the other. The book Train to Kill came about actually through the way many of these lost pieces of or little known pieces of history do, and that is just an awful lot of luck. I happen to have worked with Antonio Vesiana's daughter when I was working at the Miami Herald, and she came to me. She knew I was writing books, and she came to me and asked me if I would meet with her father and talk to him about his story. And interestingly enough, he's a very very humble guy, a very practical man, who at now 88 years old has the advantage of looking back on his life with a lot of lessons learned and a lot of wisdom gained. And when I first met him, he said, "Mine is the life of a failure. That's what this story is." Which I thought, well, I hope he's wrong. And luckily, in getting to know him, I think I'm certain that he's wrong. He was recruited, trained by the CIA to become an operative inside Cuba almost immediately after Fidel Castro took power. They used his position. He at the time was the comptroller at one of the most powerful banks, a high executive at one of the most powerful banks in Cuba, owned by the wealthiest man in Cuba's history, the sugar baron Julio Lobo. And they came to him knowing that he had stood up to the regime's pressures when he became president of the Accountants Association, the CPAs Association. And so they came to him and talked about the problems that Cuba faced using kind of code language. The person who came to meet him identified himself as Maurice Bishop. supposedly an American working for a Belgian mining company in Cuba. And later on, it turned out that this Maurice Bishop was a man that Antonio was able to identify as David Atlee Phillips, who went from being a basically just an agent in Havana to becoming head of Cuban operations for the agency, to eventually becoming head of Western Hemispheric operations, Western Hemisphere operations for the agency, and was involved in the Bay of Pigs, was involved in getting Antonio to do his work, which went from propaganda eventually to assassination plots, and then eventually was very disgruntled, very upset by the failure of the Bay of Pigs. He blamed Kennedy. And as Antonio told me and is in the book, he said, "I don't know who killed John Kennedy, but I know who wanted to." And that man who wanted to was David Atlee Phillips. He was the, as I say, by the time he had been head of Cuba, he was brought back to Washington, and he invited Antonio to a meeting in Dallas in September of 1963. At that meeting, he introduced Antonio to a man named Lee, who a few weeks later, when Antonio saw that same pasty-faced, frail, thin, kind of wild-eyed man on TV, he realized that Lee was Lee Harvey Oswald, and that he was in danger because he was now a link between either the CIA or a rogue element of the CIA, and the man who had just been accused of assassinating the American president. Hmm. It's a tale that takes it, you know, it's kind of interesting to be brought in to work on it when I did, because right now we're at a different stage of our relations with Cuba. Not sure where it's going to go, but the fact is that I got to work on this book and see inside the Machiavellian operations of the CIA, their intense desire to make the world operate in what they deemed would be the best interests of the United States, at a time when, you know, it basically bookends the regime, the Castro regime, because it starts with Antonio fighting against Fidel Castro from within Cuba right after Castro takes power. Basically, Antonio was not a supporter of Fulgencio Batista, the president who was deposed and eventually fled Cuba when Fidel Castro came marching into Havana. But few people were. It was a corrupt government. He ran with his cronies and payoffs. The military was very oppressive. The military and the police had no qualms of beating people, locking them up, or just disappearing people at the time. And so Antonio was against that, as were many of his college age and young professional friends. In fact, Antonio's best man at his wedding died in the attack on the Moncada military barracks that gave Fidel Castro's revolution its name on the 26th of July in 1953. It was the 26th of July movement is what he called it. So Antonio was no fan of what had been. And in that way, his story actually parallels the Cuban exile experience in the sense that so many of them were against this one dictator. They saw in Fidel and the rebels fighting, and it wasn't just Fidel, there were several other leaders, but Fidel came to prominence to lead them all. They saw in him a savior, excuse me, and what they got instead was someone who, once he got into power, seized and clamped down and took that power and made it even more rigid. And so he turned it into eventually a totalitarian state. As Antonio saw that, he rose up to fight against him. And that fight, I mean, you know, it's fascinating. Here's a guy, by his own description, Antonio was a sickly, skinny, asthmatic kid, grew up poor. His mom was determined and argued with the Jesuit priests at his Catholic church to get them, actually the Marist order, to get him to be allowed to attend their private school at a reduced rate. And he grew up to be an accountant and grew up to be a smart one. He used his brain because he couldn't even play any sports because of his asthma. So what the CIA saw in him was an opportunity to use someone who had connections, was in a position to gain information, understood the economy of Cuba better than these rebels who had come to power, certainly. And they used that position to try to destabilize the government. And that's how it first began. And as I say, you know, the book is coming out, is finished, at a time when that we're talking about new relations between the end of the Cold War relations to some degree between Cuba and the United States, at least an opening of discussions and an opening of their economy, opening to travel, and Fidel Castro died just before the book came out. So as I said, it's this amazing half century of Cold War aggression between this dominant power to the north, the giant of the north, with this thorn in its heel, which is Cuba and the Caribbean. I mean, really, why would Cuba have so much importance relative to its size? It took on superpowers in the sense that, you know, it had the Soviet backing because it was this communist little seed in the Caribbean that just made the United States crazy. And so they fought for all these years. Yeah.
Carla, just one final question for you. Today we speak of terrorism and terrorist organizations as something that is completely un-American and foreign to the American experience of domestic and international activities and politics. However, when it comes to the United States' intelligence war against Castro, we supported terrorism. And one of the groups is Alpha 66, which was founded in part by the gentleman that you interviewed, who's still alive, and comprised of U.S. government-trained Cuban exiles. So what was Alpha 66, how was it funded, and what was its mission?
Alpha 66 was formed at the direction of Maurice Bishop, the CIA operative who Antonio later identified as David Atlee Phillips. And he told him that he should start this and that they should make targets of any Soviet or other friendly government ships that would be supplying Cuba. If possible, they should try to cause damage within the country. Before Antonio even left Cuba, he was supplied with incendiary devices and became the chief of sabotage operations for one of the groups inside Cuba, burning down giant department stores. They were as much economic targets as they were psychological targets. You know, Antonio looks back on many of these things, and I was with him just the other day, and this point came up. And he said again, he goes, I was a soldier. You look at things differently, and the politics are different then. As a man, did I want to kill people? Did I want to be responsible for people's deaths? No. I wanted to free Cuba, and that's what I was fighting for. So I think that, you know, whether you agree or disagree with that mentality, we've certainly heard it from others. And you know, it is the way people act when they believe that they have the sanction of a greater cause.
We see that right now in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria. The problem from my perspective is, and even with Cuba, I was in Cuba, I wanted to get the story for myself. I didn't want to be propagandized. by other people who were fervent believers that the best thing that could have happened to Cuba was Castro, especially after all the tyranny and of the corrupt regime that it overthrew. But there are consequences, and if you're not willing to look at the consequences of what happens when something is overthrown, then I believe that you are lacking moral responsibility. So there's arguments that can be made for both sides of this issue, just like there are arguments that can be made of why people believe Hillary Clinton and Bill Maher and others that what we're doing in Syria is the right thing and what we did in Libya was the right thing. But then now go ask the people whose lives were affected or taken by what you thought was the right choice. And that shows you how limited we are as human beings in respecting the sacredness of the other. But this is for another discussion. I'm interested
well,
in...
I have to agree with you on that, on all of those points. I mean, and again, people justify, as you well know, people justify it by their own beliefs. Where they stand frames their vision, and they use that vision to sometimes to condemn others for their vision, but many times just to justify their own view of the world. You know, a lot of people say, do unto others, as you would have them do unto you. But what they really mean is make sure everybody does it the way you tell them to.
Yep.
So, you know, you got to watch out.
Well, Carlos, I thank you for coming on. And the book is called Trained to Kill, The Inside Story of CIA Plots Against Castro, Kennedy and Che, written with Antonio Feciana. And the website is carlosharrison.com. Thank you for being there, and hopefully this message will resonate and people will see another vista of understanding of what goes on in someone's mind, others' minds. And we didn't know about this. Now we do.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's great being with you.
All the best. Have a nice day, everyone.